It's the NPR News Update for Thursday, July 31st. Hi, I'm Phil Picardi. It's a big news day. Today, detailed reports about our top three stories. Target has a new leader. Archbishop Neinstedt gives his first broadcast interview in months. And first, police shot and captured 39-year-old Brian Fitch last night. That followed an eight-hour manhunt for the killer of a Mendota Heights police officer. Peter Cox reported.
Officer Scott Patrick was shot in West St. Paul in the middle of the day. Kimberly Alley was on her way back to work at Health Partners when she saw a woman jump out of an SUV screaming that a police officer had been shot.
And I pulled around and there was a nurse giving him chest compressions and he was not doing very well. And went over and took his pulse and he was not... I can't pronounce him dead, but he was not doing very well, and it's really a tragic, horrible, horrible scene.
Patrick was taken to Regent's Hospital, where he died. Meanwhile, police began searching for a green Pontiac sedan seen speeding from the scene. Law enforcement from several local police departments, SWAT teams, and the FBI also searched neighborhoods. By late afternoon, their search concentrated on Brian Fitch Sr., and police asked for the public's help to find him. The massive manhunt started in Mendota Heights, where police squads went to two separate residences. At a home on Pond Circle East, police moved in. Marie Paucan was working in her basement when she heard a commotion outside.
When I got to my window, I noticed the entire street was lined with police officers, weapons drawn, shotguns. There were troopers, there were undercover cops, there were all varieties of police officers, and they were throughout the whole neighborhood. The whole street was blocked.
Law enforcement then searched an area on the west side of St. Paul, not far from Humboldt High School. SWAT officers with guns drawn crouched behind their SUV doors and stood near a concrete wall. For more than an hour, a seven-block stretch of South Robert Street was closed, and a crowd formed along stretches of yellow police tape. But then suddenly, just before 8 p.m., the police cleared out of the west side and gathered to just north of the state capitol, where police spotted Brian Fitch Sr. driving down Sycamore Street. Police say when he tried to make a U-turn in a parking lot, officers blocked him in. St. Paul Police Sergeant Paul Palos described what happened next.
As the main driver police officer got out of his squad car, Fitch opened up and started a fire on that particular officer. Officers from the passenger side of their vehicle at that time returned fire, striking Fitch several times.
Fitch was taken to Regent's Hospital. A woman in the car with him was also struck, but Paolo said her injuries were not life-threatening. Fitch has a lengthy criminal history, according to state records. He has felony convictions for assault with a dangerous weapon and misdemeanor convictions for making terroristic threats in 2013 and for first-degree assault in that same year. In June, authorities declared Fitch a fugitive. Investigators now hope to find out more about the shooting. Officer Scott Patrick had been with the Mendota Police Department since 1995 and was its most senior officer. He leaves behind a wife and two teenage children. Mendota Heights Police Chief Mike Ashenbrenner remembered him at a news conference.
He was a very dedicated police officer and a family man who absolutely adored his children. It's going to be a very trying time for them. He cared deeply about the city of Mendota Heights, and it's going to be a very tough time for the Mendota Heights Police Department.
Patrick is the first police officer from Mendota Heights to be killed in the line of duty. At an evening vigil near the West St. Paul intersection where gunshots broke open a normal day, John Plute talked about what made him drive from Eagan.
Felt like I had to do something, so I just headed over here and hopefully support what's going on here. It's a good turnout and a really senseless act. Can't quit shaking my head over it. It's just, what do you say, you know?
A fund for Scott Patrick's family was launched last night on the website GoFundMe.com. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis-based Target has picked a new chairman and chief executive. He is Brian Cornell, an executive at Pepsi. Before that, he led divisions of Sam's Club and Michael's Foods. Carrie Miller talked about it with an analyst this morning.
Turning now to Duane Stanford. He is a reporter for Bloomberg. He covers the industry, and he's with us from Atlanta. What should we understand about Brian Cornell in taking the helm of a company with the kind of challenges that Target has had?
Well, first of all, he's got a lot of experience at retail, especially with food retailers. He was previously ran Sam's Club for Walmart. And now in the last 2.5 years, he's run a very large division of PepsiCo called PepsiCo America's Foods that, you know, has brands like Frito-Lay and is about a half of PepsiCo's overall business. People think of it as a beverage company because of the name, but it's really as much or more a food company. And he's been in charge of helping them fight through some pretty difficult waters over the last 2 years. And one of his one of the key things he's done is help them get better at food service and become more of a player at food service against Coca-Cola, bringing products like Doritos tacos to Taco Bell.
So Duane, have those difficult waters that he's navigated this section of PepsiCo through included the kind of challenges that are coming at Target from the digital realm? I mean, that I would think that's going to be one of his key priorities, how to manage that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. He's going from, you know, being an insider at PepsiCo to now being one of PepsiCo's bigger customers. And the challenges that he faced at Pepsi are going to be a different set for sure than what he faces at Target. I mean, Target right now is dealing with a Canadian expansion that didn't go well. They've become risk adverse in the U.S., as it's the interim CEO has said. And then, as you mentioned, they've got this this need to convert from bricks and mortars to more web-based shopping, which is where more of the shopping consumers are going. So those are some of the areas that he's going to have to figure out if he's going to be successful there.
I was reading an old interview that he did with a leadership organization a couple years ago, and one of the things that he said in the interview was, one of the great things that you have to do as a company and as a leader is to be aware of your customers' pain points and alleviate them. Now, of course, he comes in after Target has had this experience with the security breach, and there were some pain points for Target customers on that. I would think part of this priority is restoring whatever trust still needs to be managed and confidence in Target as a leader in the industry.
That's exactly right. I mean, you've got the data trust issue, which is more black and white, but you've also got a situation, for instance, in Canada, where Walmart came back and really started beating them on price, and it also sent some Canadians over the border into the U.S. for cheaper prices. So, one of the things that Target has tried to do over the years is sort of have this sort of trendy kind of cheap, chic image where, it's like you don't want to shop at Walmart. You don't want to go for the bottom basement prices. We're going to give you some affordable design, some more trendy kind of products like Missoni dresses, for instance. And for a while, that was working really well. Problem is, the rest of the market began to catch up, and you started seeing some of those designs and that sort of thinking at places like Kmart. So then it was time to retool, but as their interim CEO said, they just weren't taking enough risks to make that transition.
Duane Stanford is with us. If you've just tuned in, he's a reporter for Bloomberg out of Atlanta, and we're getting some insight into the background and the priorities of the new CEO of Target, named today, 55-year-old Brian Cornell. Duane, here's something else from a different interview that Cornell did where he talked about really having to understand the customer. He calls it being a student of the customer. How does Target reconnect, I guess, with its customers, given what you just described is happening in the market?
Well, I mean, you've got shoppers shopping more on the web. You've got this era of the big box sort of waning. you know, big retailers, even Walmart, are starting to create smaller stores, more accessible stores. Consumers are wanting that. So he's got to figure out how to get Target transitioned in the right way to that as well. Consumers still want cool things. They still want design. Target was known as a place where you could get this cheap design. So he's got to figure out that as well. And, of course, one important part of that is collecting data. So moving to the web is not just about where you sell your product. It's how you collect data and information and understand your consumer's desires. And that's one of the areas that they need to get better at and that he will try to help improve. Of course, he's been, you know, PepsiCo, as the major beverage companies are, do a lot of consumer insight work. They do a lot of work to understand their consumers. So he's got some experience there. So that's what he's going to have to bring to Target as well.
Yeah, I think he kind of echoes what you were just saying. He was saying it's absolutely critical with business so rapidly changing. You have to know up to the minute what is happening in the consumer environment. Dwayne, would you say is Amazon, is a site like that Target's chief competition? Not to diminish Walmart and some of the other companies you mentioned, but isn't that who they're looking over their shoulder at all the time?
Yeah, pretty much all of retail, especially bricks and mortar, is looking over their shoulder at Amazon. Amazon's got tremendous scale. They've got the ability to beat you on price at a moment's notice. Those are all challenges that that Target and these other stores face. So the question is, how do you get people to look at us instead? How do we differentiate ourselves? How do we get them to come into our stores? And you know, just competing on price, especially for a bricks and mortar heavy store, is a very difficult proposition these days in terms of growth. So those are the sorts of issues you have to work out. And as the interim CEO said when he was in talking to us recently, you have to be able to give your employees, the people working at the ground level and in the executive offices, the ability to make quick decisions and to react to data and take some risks.
You just anticipated my last question here, which is about the culture inside Target. This is unusual. Target usually promotes from within. You've got an outsider coming in. How does he address that?
I think they clearly want an outside voice right now, someone from the outside who can come in and see the culture for what it is and try to make changes there. Again, it's been clearly diagnosed that there needs to be a culture shift there, especially as they face these new challenges that are coming at them very fast. And so clearly that was part of their strategy. And it'll be interesting to see how he takes all of his, you know, 20-plus years of expertise in these different areas and applies it to this retailer and tries to help it remake itself.
I was just going to say, I mean, yes, the people inside Target and, of course, the investors and shareholders on the outside want to change, but that's a very specific culture inside that company. He may have a challenge ahead on that part of it, too, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I think you've hit on a very important point. I mean, you've seen other outsiders come into businesses, and you know, the idea always sounds really fantastic. JCPenney was a classic example, and of course,
right,
there were other factors there. But you know, you had an Apple guy come in, and it was much more difficult to make changes, and he moved too quick. So one of the things people will be watching is whether he comes in there and takes a methodical approach within this fast-paced environment he's trying to create, or if he maybe moves too fast as well.
Dwayne, really grateful for the time and the insight today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dwayne Stanford is a reporter for Bloomberg talking to us out of Atlanta.
That is Carrie Miller talking about the new leader of Target this morning on The Daily Circuit. Faced with growing calls for his resignation, Archbishop John Neinstedt has come forward to defend his handling of the clergy sexual abuse scandal. In his first broadcast interview since the scandal broke last September, Neinstedt told reporter Madeline Barron that he has no plans to leave his position as head of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis. Neinstedt defended his decisions and said some have tried to discredit him with rumors of sexual misconduct. Here's Madeline Barron.
For months, Neinstedt has told his colleagues at the Chancery in St. Paul, "I am not a quitter." When I spoke with him yesterday, he made it clear that he has no plans to resign. He says he's been misunderstood over the past year, as Catholics reacted to reports from NPR News that showed Neinstedt and other bishops protected priests accused of sexually abusing children.
You know, I think the role of the bishop is that of more of a father figure to a spiritual community of faith as opposed to a CEO. And I think there's a momentum here that we're much better off today than we were. And I want to be a part of that, and I want to continue to lend my support to that. We've learned an awful lot of stuff over the last 10 months, and I think that we're ready to move on to a better place.
Neinstedt says he's been working hard to follow the recommendations of a task force he created last year to address the church's procedures for handling abuse allegations. He says an outside firm has reviewed 3,000 clergy files, and that the Archdiocese has changed its policy on responding to complaints of abuse.
Do you think that people will be able to trust you and to follow you?
Well, I read all my mail and all my emails that I get, and there's decidedly a group of people who have lost trust, but I think there's more than that number of people who have told me, hang in there, you know, you're doing a good job, and you know, we're going to get through this and be in a better place. So I think the you're getting one side of the story, but I see both sides of the story, and I believe that what we're going to do in the next few months is going to convince people that we're on the right track.
Neinstedt defended his decisions on several abuse cases. He says he did listen to the advice of his former chancellor, Jennifer Hasselberger, in some cases, and cut off some payments to abusive priests.
But, you know, you have to understand how the office works here. You've got several things coming at you every day. And I had to deal with them as they came up one by one by one, you know.
Documents obtained by NPR News and published over the past year show that Neinstedt knew of problems with the Archdiocese's handling of clergy sex abuse from his first month on the job, and that Hasselberger repeatedly warned him that the Archdiocese wasn't following Vatican rules. Still, the Archbishop says he was caught off guard by the reports from NPR News.
The surprise that took place when those reports started coming out last October was the breadth of the issues. And I, in a sense, didn't see the forest for the trees. I was aware of certain problems with misconduct on the part of different priests on a day-to-day basis, but I didn't get the overall picture of where we stood that someone like Jennifer, who dealt with the files every day, would have had.
So there was never a moment where you said, wait a minute, what's going on here? Big picture. It was always, here's another individual problem that we need to decide how to handle?
We were dealing with these individual situations, yes.
Okay.
And so the whole scope of the thing was not made known to me.
Neinstedt defended his decision in 2009 to appoint Father Curtis Waymire as pastor of two parishes. Hasselberger had warned Neinstedt to look at the priest's file because she was alarmed by his sexual interest in younger men. Waymire went on to sexually abuse two boys at his parish. He's now in prison.
Why did you take the risk of appointing Father Waymire pastor?
Well, I didn't think it was a risk, number one. When Jennifer brought up her objections to him being made pastor, I reviewed the file that she prepared for me. I saw that he had same-sex attractions, which doesn't preclude one from becoming a pastor. He had been gone to St. Luke's, and this was 5 years later. He had done everything they had asked him to do. He was doing spiritual direction every month. He was seeing a therapist. But there was nothing at the time that I made him pastor that I felt was serious enough to not make him a pastor. Jennifer didn't agree, but Jennifer had had a couple of run-ins with him.
So you think it was more of a personal disagreement?
I think so.
So some of the things that have been more alarming to people that have been responding to our initial reporting on Father Waymire are the incidents like in the bookstore where he's approaching these younger men, at least according to them, saying sexually explicit things. Those kinds of statements don't disqualify someone from becoming the pastor?
Well, he had gone to St. Luke's and had been evaluated and had received a treatment. It had been 5 years since anything like that had happened. And I believe that people can reform and be reformed and learn from their mistakes.
Do you think it was a mistake to appoint a pastor, looking back on it now?
Well, I did that appointment with the best lights of the judgment I could make. I consulted the Comprehensive Assignment Board, as I do in every instance of making a priest a pastor, and there were no objections from that group. That's the representative group of priests who are elected according to different age levels of the priests. I consulted my auxiliary bishop, and except for Jennifer, there was really no objection. So I felt he was ready and able and certainly willing to take on that that position.
Neinstedt also faces scrutiny from a private investigation he commissioned into his own private life. The Archbishop declined to say much about that investigation. NPR News has previously reported that the investigation involves at least one allegation that Neinstedt engaged in sexual misconduct with an adult. Why did you decide to commission the investigation into yourself?
Well, it was around the time that that other false accusation was made against me about the confirmation candidate. And all of a sudden, it seemed like rumors and innuendos were coming out of the woodwork. And I didn't have anything to hide. I know that I've not done anything immoral or criminal or anything that of that nature. And so when this came to the attention of my staff, they said, well, we should probably investigate it. We would with any priest. And I said, sure, I have nothing to hide.
What is it that is being investigated as far as you understand it?
Well, I can't get into that because when I started the investigation, I handed the authority of that over to Bishop Beauchamp. And I told him that I would not interfere. So it really would be inappropriate for me to comment on that at this time. I'm very hopeful that they're near the end of this thing and that we can get some resolution of it as soon as possible.
And what does the end look like? What will happen at the very end of it to close it?
I have no idea because I'm not involved in it day to day.
Neinstedt says the Archdiocese is paying for the investigation, but that he doesn't know how much it costs. What is being alleged here, as far as what the lawyers are telling people, is that you have engaged in sexually inappropriate behavior or advances with other men. Is that true?
It is not true, no.
And that there are more than one of these rumors that are going around. Is that your understanding, that they are looking into more than one allegation?
Yes. How many? I'm not sure the whole number, but I believe it's more than one, yes.
And that this involves in situations that are alleged to have occurred in Detroit and elsewhere. Are you aware of the scope of it in that sense?
Well, I was interviewed by the interviewers, and they came up with different situations, so yes. But again, I really shouldn't be commenting on the investigation itself.
The lawyers in charge of the investigation told Hasselberger that they were looking into whether Neinstedt had an inappropriate relationship with Father Wehmeyer.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely false. Father Wehmeyer had me over for dinner the first night that I went to bless his altar. I made him pastor, and then he had a DWI, I think, in the fall of 2009. I called him to find out how he was doing, as I call every other priest. He said he was going stir crazy. I said, well, how about if I take you out for dinner? So I did. And then he reciprocated some months later when he was back driving at a restaurant owned by a friend of his. So that would have been 3 meals in 3 years. I don't know that that's an inappropriate relationship.
Neinstedt says he's not sexually attracted to men.
And I also want to say that I'm not anti-gay. A lot of the feedback I got during the marriage amendment was the fact that I was a bigot and I was a homophobe and all this kind of stuff. I respect every person, man, woman, and child, for their dignity as a son and daughter of God. But no, I'm not struggling with those attractions.
Neinstedt says he thinks the allegations against him are part of an attempt to discredit him for preaching the Catholic faith.
I think if you can shoot the messenger, then you hope the message goes away.
Neinstedt says he hasn't been interviewed by police who have been investigating the Archdiocese's handling of abuse complaints. And he says the Archdiocese hasn't decided whether to file for bankruptcy in response to dozens of lawsuits filed by alleged victims of clergy sexual abuse. He says he's taking a wait-and-see approach to that issue. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And I'm Phil Picardi with Minnesota's News on Your Schedule. Thanks for coming along on this Thursday. News for the first day of August right here tomorrow on the NPR News Update.